Welcome, everybody, to the sixth Clemson Dubcast. A day early this week. Usually drop them on Fridays. Decided to get this one out a little early. Really fun conversation with Cole Kubelik, ESPN analyst, about a bunch of stuff. Really appreciate Cole's sharing his time with us. Also like his self-deprecating manner. A lot of humility with him, and that's really important, at least in my opinion, when you are in a public way, sort of scrutinizing others for a living, not taking yourself too seriously when the eye of scrutiny is turned on you. A lot of good coverage at TigerIllustrated.com this week. About to release later today, Thursday, our weekly video review segment, taking a deeper look both at Clemson's opener against Furman and Texas A&M's opener against Northwestern State. So be prepared to check that out. Plenty of other stuff. We've had some folks who learned about TigerIllustrated.com on this Dubcast and have subscribed as a result of that. So thank you all for that and welcome aboard. Title sponsor of the Clemson Dubcast, Parham Smith and Archenhold Law Firm in Greenville. Very happy to have them aboard. Couldn't do it without them. Blake Smith and Brooke Archenhold, both Clemson grads, both huge fans. Forte of their firm is medical negligence. They represent patients and their family members in medical negligence actions. They also handle all sorts of other complex personal injury litigation. I can vouch for them. About 10 years ago, a family member had a pretty serious medical situation with one of the local hospitals, went to Blake Smith, and he very quickly and authoritatively gave us some great advice, and we were very thankful for that. Parham Smith and Archenhold offers free consultations. Give them a call, 864-990-4581, or parhamlaw.com. Another supporter of the Clemson Dubcast, the Abernathy Boutique Hotel in Clemson. They've had some distinguished guests lately. Heard Nikki Haley was over there, staying there for the Furman game that weekend. Kirk Herbstreit and Reese Davis were there just yesterday. Kirk, obviously a good friend of Dabo's. He and Reese coming in to check out a practice, staying at the Abernathy. A lot of you folks I've heard went and had some fun out on their patio before and after the Furman game. They got a really cool tailgate set up there. Got a DJ sponsored by Jack Daniels, grilling hot dogs, hamburgers, cornhole, all that stuff. So definitely go pay them a visit. Georgia Southern weekend next week. A lot of fun. Right across from Lot 2, theabernathy.com. Okay, let's get to it. Cole Kubelik, enjoy. Okay, Cole Kubelik, analyst for ESPN and the SEC Network. Thank you so much for joining us, Cole.
Hey, Larry, I appreciate you having me on. Anytime.
So, you played center at Auburn from 96 to 01. It was, a redshirt year in there.
Yeah, 2000 was my last season at Auburn.
Okay, I'm sorry. And so that was under I guess, Terry Bowden and Tuberville.
Correct. Okay. Technically, Bill Oliver was our interim head coach, so he would probably have to count in there as well.
That's right. So a degree in communications and media studies, when did you know or have an idea you wanted to get into this crazy business?
Probably when I was in high school. I was that guy that rode around and on my way to school and on the way to my home from practice or two games or whatever, playing baseball or football practice, that I was listening to sports talk radio. And I listened to a lot of music too, but I was kind of a sports radio nerd back in high school. I listened to it in college and the local stuff at Auburn. And I can remember maybe even before that, because I can remember playing NBA Jam and Tech Bowl and RBI Baseball, and I would always call the games when we were doing them, and my friends thought it was funny, and sometimes would even ask me to call games when they were playing, and I was sort of sitting one out. So I always wanted to do it. And when I got out of school, you kind of get hit with that realization that, all right, I don't have any money. And you'll start looking around at internships in the media. Now, granted, this is, you know, 18 years ago. And it's like, well, yeah, we'll pay you a couple $1,000s a year or not be paid. And I wasn't really in a position to be able to do that. So I had an aunt who was in pharma sales and, you know, kind of told me about the business. And I had an uncle that was in medical sales. I saw what they had in their lives, and I was kind of like, yeah, I'd like to live like that. And so I was lucky enough to see a newspaper ad for a pharmaceutical company that was expanding and had interviews in Birmingham. And I went and got one of the guys who interviewed me happened to be a big Auburn fan. So that got me a second interview, and I kind of won him over. And luck of the draw, I ended up being a pharmaceutical rep out of college. But my first year out of college, I knew a guy that owned a rock station in Huntsville. And my dad, that's where I took the job. My dad actually lived in Huntsville when I was growing up. And he carried Auburn football. So I went to him and I said, hey, what would you think if my quarterback at Auburn, Ben Lear, lived in Decatur, Alabama at the time, which is like 20 minutes away. I said, what if Ben Lear and myself did like a pregame show? Because obviously the broadcast has a pregame show. What if we did like a pregame show? And he says, well, if you sell it, you can do it. And, you know, you guys keep your whatever percentage commission off what you sell. So we went out and we found a couple people to sponsor it and we sold it. And he put us on the air and we did that for, I think, 2 years. And then Ben moved to Auburn. So we moved the show to Auburn and expanded by like an hour and became a little bit of a bigger deal. And by doing that, I met some of the guys at the Auburn Network, saw what I was doing, and they asked me if I wanted to do a spring game because Stan White was moving from doing like the old CSS replays over to being the actual color guy on the radio broadcast. And I said, yeah, I'd love to. And so I did it. They liked it. And they said, well, would you like to do the replays for CSS in the fall? And this is when, I mean, keep in mind, CSS was, I guess, kind of a big deal. It was like Georgia. I don't know if they did any ACC stuff. I think they did Georgia Tech. I don't know if they did Clemson, but, you know, Georgia, Auburn, Tennessee, they would do almost every game and have their own replay. And then it sort of dwindled down where CBS took them away. And then when ESPN took over the rights, obviously they were gone. And when that happened, there was a guy at CSS that said, hey, I've got this Sunbelt package. Would you be interested in that? Now, I had moved over to medical sales at this point in time. This is probably 2005, six maybe. And I said, well, you know, I'm enjoying doing these Auburn games, but the Auburn games are down to one pay-per-view game a year. And this is 12, 13 games. I said, for me, based on the fact that this is what I want to do, this is a no-brainer. So I'm doing guest interview spots on radio stations around Birmingham and North Alabama. I did some Belt football games for, I think, 3 years. I had Joe Davis my first year, who's now doing games for Fox. I had Joe Block, who is one of the radio and TV guys for the Brewers, for 2 years. And then I had Tom Doerr for a year, who used to do Bulls games back in the day for a couple world championships. And really did sort of learn the ropes and learned a lot about the business, learned a lot about calling games, and really sort of fell in love with it and came to the realization that, yeah, this is absolutely what I want to do. And then just kind of as the SEC Network came around, tried to network my way in. First year that the networks announced, you know, they got Booger and Marcus and Greg and all these guys, and there's no Cole Kubelik anywhere. It was kind of hurt. It was tough. And just kept calling Stephanie Drewley, kept calling Steve Ackles, kept kind of harassing people there and showing them what I could do. And they gave me a shot on I think it was Arkansas Nickel State SEC Network alternate game. And that was sort of the first real SEC Network game that I got, and that turned into a couple more games, and that turned into Bon Bon Film Room, and, you know, turned into a 2-year contract that I signed this year and doing the primetime game. So I did radio shows in North Alabama. I took a job on WJOX in Birmingham earlier this year, which is, you know, the station I used to listen to growing up. And it's actually in Homewood, Alabama, where I grew up. So that's pretty cool. But it's been people ask me sometimes, like, you know, how do I get where you are? I want to do what you do. And I'm like, well, you don't want to take my road there, because it was a long, windy, difficult path, much different than a lot of other people are taking these days, because now you're better trained for it and there's many more opportunities.
Every veteran in your profession, my profession, probably looks back and cringes at something or some things he or she wrote or said at a time when they were just starting out and learning. I certainly apply to that more than anybody. Is there anything you look back on when you're doing the Sunbelt Games that you really learned from, something you did that you'd never do now?
It's funny that you said Sunbelt Games, because I was going to say picking NC State to go to the playoff last year. Might have been that thing. But no, that actually ended up being great, because it was a fun talking point for the entire season. And ended up being pretty cool. You know, I don't really shy away from it. I've had some stuff, you know, my personal life that I'm not 100% proud of. And that happened when I was doing those games, and it changed my life. And it kind of forced me to hang up drinking forever, which has been, you know, outside of getting married and having my two kids, the best decision that I've ever made. So for me personally, you know, that was one thing that I would regret. And, you know, I got behind the wheel of a car when I shouldn't have, and paid the price for it. And thankfully, I learned from that lesson.
You can't win in the state of Alabama. Alabama fans say you're an Auburn guy. Auburn fans get mad at you when you say anything critical of Auburn, of your alma mater. How have you learned to live with that, to deal with it? What's that like?
Dealing with it is not difficult, because kind of like what you said, you get numb to it, you become used to it. And I feel like some of the best advice that I've ever gotten was from a buddy of mine that's a scout with the Ravens. And you know, he talked about what I did and how I do it and as far as my job. And, you know, he essentially just said, listen, you might not be where you want to be right now, but your work will always present itself. And if there's one thing that I know about you, it's your work. And so that's just kind of what I've tried to do, is I've tried to always have an opinion based on what I've seen, what I've studied, what I know, as opposed to just what I think or something that would make somebody else happy or angry. I try to have educated opinions on everything, and I base that on doing my homework. So I think that the only way you can ever really excel in this profession is to sort of live it and to make it your life. And I'm not saying that my job is more important than my two children or my wife. It's not, but there are a lot of things that I have to do in this profession that are frustrating to my wife and frustrating to me because I'm not with my kids, but I know it's part of the deal. And it's the only thing that I really want professionally. So for me, it's not letting it get to you. It's not letting it affect you. It's believing in what you do and believing in what you know, because you know you put the work in. It's like, you know, it's like a lot of people, like Greg McElroy and I just compared a lot, because he's in the same situation with Alabama. And the people ask me about him, you know, why does he hate Alabama? Why does he do things? And I'm just, and it's funny, I just laugh. And I'm like, because I know Greg like I know myself. And if there's one thing that we both are semi-obsessed with, it's being right. And when you're obsessed with being right, you're going to do everything you can to have the information to back up your opinions and to back up what you say. And, you know, that's why Greg watches as much film as he does. It's why I study as much as I do, because I want to be right. And so people can not like what I say because I attended Auburn or played at Auburn, or people can not like what I say because it might not be the most positive thing about Auburn and they're an Auburn fan. But as far as I'm concerned, where I am now, that's a you problem. That's not my problem anymore. That's not something that affects me at all anymore. When I get things on Twitter like you're a Barner, or why do you hate Auburn, or he has an agenda and he's, you know, he has something against Auburn, he's got a point to prove, whatever it is, it's Larry, I literally see it and then move on. I usually see it and I mute the person and I move on. Like Fred Siegel from Old Takes Exposed introduced me to the mute button on Twitter like 2 years ago. And I didn't know what it was. And I was like, oh, this is probably dumb. And he introduced me to it. And I mean, ever since then, it's like, if you come at me with some uneducated form of an insult, I just mute you and move on. And that's it. And hopefully I'll never hear from you again. Because if that's what you take my work as, is that either someone who only attended Auburn or someone who only hates Auburn because I've got some bone to kick with Auburn, then I have there's no reason for me to interact with you. I mean, you've shown that your level of intelligence is not one that I should be interacting with you. So therefore, I'm just going to move on. And that's all right. You can go do your thing, and I'll go do my thing, and we never have to cross paths again. So it's something that's always going to be there. I get it. I think more Alabama fans, because I kind of embraced it early on in my old radio show I used to refer to as All Barn Radio. And like, I kind of owned it and used it as a joke. And I think the guys who were being sarcastic with it appreciated that. The guys who were being serious with it took it as me seriously saying, we're only going to have Auburn guests. We're only going to, I mean, how boring would that be to talk about one team 4 hours a day? Like, I couldn't live with myself if I did that. So, you know, the guys who know that I've recognized that it's funny and it's pretty ridiculous for the people who do take it serious and do think it's a real thing, I think they appreciate it more. And now we can all have fun with it. But those people who can't see that side of it are just going to be more angry and more mad and probably get muted more often.
I've heard you say people want to be mad. How does that happen? How do you explain that phenomenon?
Well, it goes back to people outside of the SEC footprint ask me to describe why the SEC is different. What's different about the SEC? The passion, what's the pageantry, and you know, the winning and this and that, whatever. I'm just like, man, the only way I can describe why the SEC is different from every other conference is that we love to hate more than we love to love. And I just think there's so much reality to that. There are so many fans, and it's not all, and I'm not painting a broad brush over Auburn fans or Alabama fans or Georgia fans or Tennessee fans or Florida fans, but there is a much larger portion of every fan base in this league, based on my experience, that loves to hate someone else more than they love to love themselves. And that's why it's just different. And it just means more is a very real thing. But a lot of times, meaning more leads to more hatred. And it's just reality. So I don't know why some people just want to be mad and want to be angry. I mean, there are people who get mad with me because I quote a tweet with a funny remark or a funny response, and they get mad at me because they're mad that I'm putting that person on blast. When I'm sitting there thinking, what the hell do you think that person deserves? When they're telling me that I'm a bad person, or they're telling me that, you know, I'm a POS or whatever, then people will defend that because I apparently put them on blast. So, you know, it's just some people just have it in them that they'd rather not be happy and they want to be miserable, and that's their prerogative and they can do it. It's just I'm not going to do it with them anymore.
You voluntarily a few minutes ago brought up your NC State prediction from last summer. I guess what did you say they were? You thought they could be a dark horse Final Four team?
You know, I had them in the playoffs last
okay.
year. I mean, I had four playoff teams and. I think I was 1-4. I got Alabama. And obviously I didn't have Clemson in because if I'm going to have it's kind of different this year than it was last year. Like now, how many analysts are saying nationally putting two teams from one conference in? Whether it's, you know, last year I would have probably had two ACC teams in, or I might have had two SEC teams in. Now this year everybody's got Auburn and Alabama, or Penn State and Ohio State, or Michigan and Wisconsin. And it's like, I would have never thought that was humanly possible going into last year. So obviously by thinking NC State could pull it off, and I'll still back it up. I'll still back up what my mindset was going into last season. And that was with the way they managed their offense and Jalen Samuels, a 90-yard returning, a pretty good offensive line, a really good quarterback, that I thought offensive line play across that league was going to be down. And I thought outside of Clemson, NC State had the best defensive line. I thought where they caught them on the schedule was good. And I just figured that they would be able to sort of pull the upset. They had played Clemson tight for a few years. And, you know, maybe they get over the hump. Because I had them in the bowl game and I studied them extensively and I liked what I saw. Obviously, Clemson made me look bad because they were a dominant football team last year. I think we had Alabama in, and that was it. Because I think I went Stanford, too, which was just a bad pick. It'd be worse than NC State. But, you know, you just I thought, based on the schedule, based on what they had returning, and then based on what other teams had returning, and that's the thing that I think people forget to look at. Like, it's easy to just go pick a logo and say Ohio State's in, or Oklahoma's in, or Washington's in. Like, I go look at the schedules and look at the matchups and think, all right, who can be problematic for who's on their schedule? So I don't really pick a playoff team just based on who they are and who they have. Like, matchups decide games. And so it's one of the reasons I went with NC State last year, the main reason, really.
Yeah, the point wasn't to dissect the pick. And really, NC State was a really good team. The point was you voluntarily brought that up in a self-deprecating way. And I heard you, I think, on another podcast say that one of the most important lessons you learned at some point was don't be afraid to admit you're wrong about something. Can you maybe elaborate on that?
It's the number one phrase of advice that I give people that want to get into this industry. Because first and foremost, let's just be honest with ourselves. You're going to be wrong. And it's not quite funny to me when people get mad at people's picks, and it's like, you realize we're going to be wrong probably more than we're going to be right, or else we would all be living in Las Vegas gambling our hearts away being millionaires. Like, I mean, that's what it is. So, never. I learned my lesson early on, and I don't know if I really learned it, but maybe I learned to appreciate it. Like, I saw Rolando McClain play in high school, and he was really good and really talented, but I saw him kind of shut it down at the end of a game that they were losing in person. And that kind of attitude kind of led me to believe that I didn't know if he's really going to be successful for Nick Saban. So it was like, my expectations for him are low, and I'm not expecting him to be an impact player right away. I was a guest on a radio show in Birmingham. It was a round table on Jocks, the station I'm on now. They're on in the mornings now. And this guy calls in, and he brings that up. And he's like, you said Rolando McClain wasn't going to be an impact guy. You said you didn't think Rolando McClain would amount to much because of his attitude and blah, blah, whatever. And I just said, you know what, man, you're wrong. And I was wrong. And I swung and I missed. And that was a gigantic whiff on my part. And I'll probably be wrong again, but I was asked for my opinion, and I gave it. And it was an educated opinion based on what I saw in person. And the guy literally didn't know what to say. He just sat there on the phone. I'm like, no, man, you got me. I was wrong. And it's the same people that still bring up the NC State pick from last year. I was like, I don't know how many times I have to tell you guys I missed that. And I was wrong on that, but I'm not trying to pretend like I wasn't. So I think the most valuable lesson that you can learn if you're going to be in this business, being an analyst, picking games, talking about why someone's going to win, is you better be able to admit when you were wrong, because you're going to be. And if you try to cover it up and you try to disguise it, you're only going to get caught and you're only going to look worse. And that's just what I've learned from doing this for a short period of time.
I tell people that the best part of this job is that it's not 9 to 5, Monday through Friday. But also maybe the worst part is that it's not 9 to 5 and that you're always sort of on call. You're literally bringing your home work, your work home with you. You're thinking about it all the time. That can be rough when you have a family and kids. How hard is it for you to balance that with your really super busy schedule?
It's 1,000 times easier because of my wife. And my wife is my best friend. My wife is essentially, you know, my agent. My wife is my business partner. My wife is my number one fan. My wife is my voice of reality. And my wife keeps me in check, but my wife also motivates me. My wife cheers me on. And my kids mean the world to me. So having to go out of town 3 or 4 days a week is extremely difficult. You know, thankfully, we have FaceTime now, and that helps a little bit. But she knows how much this means to me. She knows how much I love doing this. She knows how much there's nothing else I want to do. Like, really want to do. And I think she also sees that how rare it is in life for people to do something and get paid for it and literally never go to work. Like I tell people all the time, I haven't been to work in 5 years. You know, I took a year off in like 2013 or 14, something like that, because I had to walk away from a radio station in Huntsville, Alabama, because I just couldn't do it anymore. And I went and tried to sell packaging, like sell boxes, and I hated myself. I hated my life. It just wasn't for me. And like I've tried to sell insurance and I hated it. It wasn't for me. And these are all after I had a little bit of a taste of being in the media. So that compounded even more. And, you know, a couple of years ago, before I got this deal with ESPN, we sat down before the season. And the year before, we had only had, I think I did like 3 games that year. It was the first year that ESPN took over all the rights. And before, when we were approaching the next season, and I was kind of talking to some guys and didn't really know what I was going to have. And she's like, listen, we need to sit down and talk about this. And she said, I believe in you. I trust you. I have full confidence in you. I know you're good enough to do this. She said, but if this doesn't work out this year, we've got to find something for you to do that you're going to enjoy, because I can't have Cole home on Saturdays in the fall because I can't be around you. Because I was miserable. I wanted to be working. I wanted to be calling games. And she's like, you're a miserable human being to be around on Saturdays in the fall. Because I just wanted to work. I didn't care if it was Mountain West, Pac-12, SEC, whatever. I just wanted to call games. And I said, all right, we're gonna get through this fall, and then we'll figure it out. And I think I did like 12 games that year, and then I did like 18 games the next year, and then I got on a regular crew. So it sort of was a slow climb. But it ends up working itself out. My point in that is that, you know, she knows. She knows what this means. So she goes above and beyond to help me, to help our family, and to help make it work. Maybe not even help make it work. Like, she makes it work. So being able to do what I do, I owe a ton of it to her, considering the fact that I can have a family at the same time.
Business owners, I want to tell you about Tandem Payment, based right here in the upstate. They are changing the face of payment processing, quickly becoming the most cost-effective solution for all small businesses. They are headquartered right here in Greenville, South Carolina, also have offices located throughout the Southeast. One of the owners, 2005 Clemson grad. Also, Hot Rod McDowell is an employee over at Tandem Payment. Business owners listening, you know how painful it is to get the weekly phone calls from the national processing companies promising, quote, the lowest rates in the industry. Tandem approaches this business completely differently, face to face. Why would you trust the majority of your hard-earned money to somebody over the phone? Tandem utilizes a consultative approach where they look out for the best interest of their potential clients. Not some crazy introductory offer here. They save you up to 90% on processing charges, and it gives your customers what they love most, choices. Want to know more? Just visit tandempayment.com. 864-672-1570. You did 2 games last week. Is that your normal routine, 2 games a week?
We've done it the last 2 years on opening weekend, yes. So, yeah, it's a blast. Like, I came home Sunday and I was like, man, I can't believe we just did that because it happened so quick. But, yeah, we did that on opening weekend last year. So, that's a rough weekend, and I've had some other, you know, bowl games, and I had Mississippi State on a Friday night a few years ago, and then had Boise on Saturday night. So that was kind of a crazy weekend. But, you know, thankfully my bosses at WJOX are very understanding, and they allow me to go do these games, and my wife does everything she can to make it feasible.
And you also host a morning show. What's the time slot?
I'm actually middays now. I'm 10 to 2 on WJOX. The show is three-man front on Jackson, Birmingham.
Okay, so during a normal week during the season where you're doing one game, can you take the listeners through your daily routine? I guess you didn't expect to be on the phone for 2 hours, but...
No. It's just funny that I can remember being asked this question 2 years ago. And then 3 years ago when I didn't have any kids. And, I mean, it was film session, grind city, every day, every morning, every night, staying up late during the day. And obviously now it's not the same way. So now I have to pick and choose what I want to see, what I need to see, what I have to see. I've become much more efficient at just getting through a game to see a certain guy or a certain position group and, you know, have an educated opinion on it based on that. But it's much more difficult now because when I get home, the last thing I'm able to do or even really want to do is put on film for 2 hours. And I want to hang out with my kids until they go to bed. And, you know, we've got a routine where my wife usually gives my son a bath and puts him to bed, and I give my daughter a bath and put her to bed. I want to do that as many nights as I can. And then when they go to bed, I usually watch a game or two or at least one side of the ball from somebody that I know I need to see. And I've got my iPad up during my radio show. So commercial breaks, I'm getting like a series or two in, just trying to get in whatever I can. Sometimes in the morning, if I'm able to get out of the house a little bit early before I start doing show prep, I'll watch a game or two. We have conference calls throughout the week. And then a lot of my time, too, is calling people that I trust, calling guys that I trust that have seen other things, that watch other games, and just getting their opinion on certain guys and certain teams and certain position groups and matchups and just kind of what they saw. So I've got a network that I trust that I try to talk to regularly during the season, and I've got, you know, a lot of film to watch and break down and a lot of numbers to look at and sort of try and decipher. And then, you know, my show prep is usually right before I go to bed because I want as much to happen before I actually get into that. So I'll spend 30, 45 minutes, an hour on show prep before I go to sleep. And then usually I get into the office. You know, right now I'm dropping my daughter off at 9 every day. So I usually drop her off and then it's 2 or 3 minutes to the station. And we have a production meeting at 9:30. So I'm kind of sitting in the house doing some extra stuff before that takes place. When everybody's getting ready to get out and just trying to kind of go through what happened the night before, anything breaking, and just have my notes aside for 4 hours of radio every day.
What makes a good sideline reporter?
I'm going to say this, and I'm not trying to be a jerk. You'd have to ask a sideline reporter. I consider myself to be a sideline analyst, and I do think that those roles are different. Now, I still ask questions, and I still interview coaches, but I don't think my job is to necessarily consistently just report on things. I think my job is more to give an opinion on what I see and what's developing and what's happening. So I think what makes a good sideline analyst is first and foremost paying attention to what your two broadcast partners are saying, paying attention to not only what you see happen within a play, but how are coaches reacting, how are players reacting, what's happening on the sideline, and to be able to give that information to the viewer. The things that those two up top can't see that I have the availability to see, sharing those things with the viewer. Why is something taking place? Why and how are certain people doing certain things? And trying to share that to help the viewer get a better understanding of just the overall game experience.
I guess I'm going to interject my opinion here, but what really bothers me when I see sideline reporters doing their halftime interviews with coaches is you can have a huge play at the end of the half, like a Hail Mary, and then the sideline reporter already has his or her question canned, like, what do you think of your running game? Are there any pet peeves that you have in some of the things you see sideline reporters / analysts, how they do their jobs?
I have enough. I got so many pet peeves myself that I don't have time to have any for anybody else. You know, there are a lot of people that I look up to in this business. Tom Luganville has been probably number one for me because he's sort of the godfather of this role, and he's the guy that I'll text or call or ask, or when he gets a chance, he's always watching my games, and he'll send me that was a great hit, or I really appreciated how you went there. And I think for me, and that goes back to what I just said about paying attention to, you know, what's happening in the game, paying attention to when things happen in the game. So for me, I do have a process of questions. I have things that I like, things that I think I want to ask. And then I have a producer that I talk to in the truck that I say, hey, you know, what do you think about this? What do you think about that? And he'll say, well, what about going this direction with this question? Or if we're going to talk quarterback, maybe you ask him this about the quarterback. And so I like to have things bounce off other people because you know, it's kind of like I told you earlier, admitting when you're wrong. I know that I don't have the best question for every scenario. So if I have people at my disposal to ask if they maybe have a better idea for a question, then yeah, why would I not do that? So, you know, a lot of different ways to ask questions. It's not my strength. It's something that I continue to work at and I continue to want to get better at. But it's a challenge that I accept, and it's something that I like. I mean, I enjoy trying to get something out of these coaches that the viewer would enjoy. I like trying to get something out of these coaches that the viewer may not have thought of. And so it can be challenging. I can tell you firsthand experience. You go into some of those interviews with two set questions and two totally different things come out. I've done it. I've done it plenty of times. And I've gotten texts about it. Like, what the hell was that? And, you know, sometimes it just doesn't happen. You know, it's like a quarterback that has a wide open out route. Sometimes that ball sails 10 yards over his receiver. Sometimes it just happens. Your mechanics break down, and you know what you tell your body to do doesn't exactly happen the way that you're telling it to do it.
It's just such an uncomfortable interaction in general, because the last thing the coach wants to do is to talk to a reporter. He wants to get to the locker room and talk to his team. Do you think that you having played the game gives you a better rapport in those settings to where the coaches feel more comfortable talking to you?
I hope so, because that's one of the main reasons I'm down there, is that perspective that I know what it is and I know what it's like and I know certain things to look for, whether it's how a guy is interacting with his teammate or a coach or what a coach is saying or what something means when I see it. So I hope that's a big part of it, and I hope that they respect that. Now, by saying that, do I think that they should respect me more than Laura Rutledge or Maria Taylor or Chris Budden? Absolutely not. Maybe just a different amount of respect or a different type of respect, or maybe they should just expect different style questions from me. But I don't believe that I should be more respected than anybody else that does my job or does a similar job. I just think that they're two different roles. So I hope that maybe that helps them understand why I would ask something. And if it's something that maybe frustrates them, they know that I've been there and done it, so they understand why I would want to share that with other people. And so hopefully that does give me an advantage, because that's why I think I'm down there.
What was your reaction when Saban went off on Maria Taylor for simply asking him what he learned about the quarterback about his quarterbacks?
I didn't think Maria deserved it. I thought it was a very fair question. I thought she handled it extremely well, like a total pro. And if you go back, and I mean, people get obsessed with what people hear what they want to, and people heard what they want to with that question. But if you go back and listen to it, she asked him to give a fair assessment, essentially asked him to praise both guys, which is, people are mad that, you know, he's mad that she was asking him to praise one, which would essentially put the other down. And I don't think that's where she was going. She just asked, what have you learned about both? Which easily could have said two positive things about each guy. So she knows how to ask questions. She's great at her job, and she didn't deserve that. But you heard Nick come out on Monday and say, hey, I should handle myself better. This is why I was angry, and this is why I lashed out. So I do think sometimes in the media we forget how intense a lot of these situations are. I'm not excusing Nick Saban for what he did, because it was totally uncalled for. But there are a lot of times with players saying things, doing things, coaches saying things, acting a certain way, that we forget that it's a pretty high stress level position, pretty intense arena that these guys are in. Don't deserve a pass, but maybe just have an understanding that sometimes things are going to happen without them maybe putting their full amount of thought process into it.
Was Tommy Bowden the offensive coordinator at Auburn when you were there for 1 year, I guess?
Wide receiver coach and offensive coordinator, yeah.
For one of the seasons you were there?
I think two, maybe.
Okay.
I know he was there in 96. I can't remember if he left in 97 or not.
Did he recruit you?
He did not, no.
Okay.
I was recruited by Rodney Allison, who played at Texas Tech and was our running back coach. Great guy, great coach. Tommy was awesome. I love being around him. I used to love talking to him. Players coach, related to the kids extremely well. It was no surprise to me that he went to Tulane and Clemson and had success. Just guys just gravitated to him. And he just sort of had that it factor, similar to his dad. You know, Terry had it too. They just so personable that they were hard not to like and hard not to enjoy being around. They had none of that, you know, none of that MF or none of that felt the need to berate guys and cuss at them and yell at them and punch them and spit on them that other coaches have. There was none of that in Terry or Tommy.
Dabo, of course, was the receivers coach at Alabama during that time. Did you ever have any interactions with him back then?
No, I haven't had much interaction with Dabo at all, really. But obviously, I know guys in Birmingham that know him and know about him. I used to work with one of his teammates, and I heard a lot of stories about him. And you know, I've obviously followed what he's done. But I think there's a lot of that mold that he takes on, a lot of that persona that he takes on. You know, I have such an appreciation for that. And being with Dan Mullen down in Florida this past weekend, he talked to us about how they have spent a lot of time trying to help that team find the fun in football again, because it should be. It's not a job. It's not a career. You can make it that if you want, but at the end of the day, when you step between those lines, it should be fun and you should enjoy it. And there are so many coaches that just suck the life out of it and suck the fun out of it and suck the enjoyment out of it. And it's sad. It's pathetic, really, because they're doing that for themselves. They're sucking the life out of it and the fun out of it, so hopefully they can be more successful. They're doing it at players' expense. They are sucking the fun out of the game at the expense of the player to hopefully help themselves down the road. And that's really pathetic and sad. But I think Dabo understands, hey, man, this is a game. This is football. Like, there are other things that are bigger than this. You're going to do a lot more things in life that mean a lot more. That doesn't mean it doesn't have to mean a lot, or it can't mean a lot. And it can still mean a ton, but it can also be fun at the same time. So I have a serious admiration for a lot of parts of who Dabo Swinney is as a coach, but that may be at the top of my list.
Now, Jimbo Fisher was your OC when?
97, 98. I think Terry was listed as the OC, but Jimbo was calling the plays. I mean, Jimbo was the brains behind the operation, really.
Okay, so you obviously have a relationship with Jimbo. You went and did the A&M spring game this past spring. You also, of course, did A&M's opener last week. What is your takeaway for that sort of project? I don't want to call it a project because he might not be that far away. Are they far away, in your opinion?
Kind of. Depends on, I guess, how far away you thought they were and where you really think they can go. But to be honest, historically, A&M doesn't have a ton of championships. So, you know, people who are thinking that they're going to replicate what Alabama's doing are probably going to be let down. But if you don't think that they can have the A&M in the contention for the West in the next few years, I think you'll be sorely mistaken. Jimbo's a great coach. And I think you look at a couple of guys like Kellen Mond and Nick Starkle, I don't think they've had anywhere near the quarterback tutoring that they're going to get under Jimbo, just because of what it means to Jimbo, how extensive he is in his training. That you'll see those guys progress a lot more, a lot faster than maybe a lot of people are anticipating. He's put a hell of a staff together. I mean, I played with Damian, so I know him. Tim Brewster, obviously, is a guy that has a great reputation. Jake Graham played in the league, has done a lot of great things from a coaching perspective in the league. I like Mike Elko a lot, a guy who I think will get the defense right. He kept Terry Price on board, who's an A&M alum, which you know how much it means to him. And bringing in Daryl Dickey as an offensive coordinator to sort of bump ideas off of and be able to bring a different aspect of play calling in. And I think he's put a great staff together. That place has every resource possible. That place, every time I go out there, I'm amazed at just how nice it is, how friendly the people are, how cool the stadium is, how it feels like you're on the Starship Enterprise walking around the facility. I mean, it's just an awesome, awesome place. They belong in the SEC. And I think Jimbo will win there. I really do. I'm not ready to say he'll win a national championship there, but I think he'll be in contention for a playoff berth in the next 6 or 7 years. So I think he's a good fit. And I think now there's a couple schools around the country that you look at and you just kind of wonder why. Why have they not been in the mix at least a year or two? Like North Carolina is kind of that school for me. A&M is one of those schools. You sit there and you think, surely there's got to be somebody who can get in there and do it and get in there and make them what they've never been able to be before, because everything seems to sort of be falling into place. And I think A&M will absolutely be in contention to win the division and maybe go to the playoffs in the next coming probably 5-6 years.
Shorter term, as in Saturday night, how do you view this matchup?
I think there are a couple parts of it that are more interesting than people are discussing. Let's look at the defense. Let's look at Jimbo and Elko. I mean, those guys have a familiarity with what Clemson does. There's a big advantage there. Now, we can flip it around and say Clemson has a pretty good idea what they do as well. So it works both ways. But I think when you're sort of the underdog team, when you're the outman team, that probably helps you a little bit more because you're going to have to do a lot more to be able to find a way to win. Clemson's not a team that pushes people around offensively. It's not what they do. Clemson creates space, and they're really good at it. And so I think when you look at where A&M has struggled up front the last few years, it's getting pushed around. And I think from a disciplinary standpoint, rather than a physical standpoint, the mental side, the disciplinary side is probably easier to fix than the physical side. The physical side is going to take a little longer. So when you look at Landis Durham, you look at Kingsley Keke, Daylon Mack, Matabuke, you look at those linebackers, Arturo Alaka and Tyrell Dodson, I mean, they've got some guys up front that can play. I mean, they got some guys on that front seven. So I think that part of it could make the game pretty interesting. And if it's going to be Trevor Lawrence, I've read a lot of his story. He competed for the job in high school, and he's king of seven on sevens and all these other quarterback things, and that's awesome. Trevor Lawrence ain't stepped in a place like this, I promise you, especially when it's going to be Saturday night. So how's that handled? How would they even handle the juggling act of two quarterbacks? Because the thing that I think about a two-quarterback system, unless you play it like the Tebow League thing, where you have one guy who can just do something that the other guy can't do and he's going to come in to do that one thing, I think mistakes become magnified. And how that should make sense is that when one guy makes a mistake, normally he may shrug that off and come out the next play and throw a dart. It's no big deal. But now you got to worry about what does that mean as far as the next guy coming in? What does that mean as far as me keeping this position, being able to play as many snaps as I thought I was going to, and moving forward, do they press to not potentially make another mistake? So it could get complicated back there. Offensively, A&M does not have the guys up front to be able to handle that defensive line. But we could probably say that about another 125 schools in college football, just being perfectly honest with you. I mean, Georgia, Wisconsin, maybe Alabama, Oklahoma. I mean, there's literally like a small handful of schools that I would say, oh, I really want to see that. Because they might be able to, I'm not going to say dominate, but they might be able to manage that group to keep them from dominating the game. And that's essentially what you're doing when you play this Clemson defensive line. Can you keep them from dominating the game? And there are not many schools in college football that are going to be able to even attempt to try to do that. So they don't have the guys up front to do it right now. But you got a fullback that you're now using who can help. You got a really good tight end who can be a mismatch problem for probably anybody they play, who can help. You've got a mobile quarterback, which maybe you can move the pocket some, have a couple design runs, at least force them to play straight up on the backside, is what I think Kellen Mond's mobility allows them to do. And I do think he's grown as a passer, both in the pocket and technically and fundamentally with how he handles himself. And they got some weapons. I mean, Travion can make plays. Javon Osmond can make plays. I mean, Javon Osmond standing next to Sternberger the other night, they were in a little stack formation. I couldn't tell which one was the tight end. I mean, he's a big physical receiver. So they got some guys, and we all know Jimbo's a good coach. Nobody doesn't think Jimbo can't call plays. So he'll have a plan together, and I think the mix of what he's allowing Mond to do that he was good at last year, that's not what normally Jimbo would do, could help give them some advantages. So do I think A&M wins the game? Probably not. But I do think that there are some matchups that could help them keep it interesting for a while. And then, like I said, if Clemson goes in there and makes a mistake or two and that crowd gets to what I've heard them be, now it gets really interesting.
Jimbo, more of a pro-style conventional guy, but he inherits an offense with mostly spread-type personnel. Do you see him adapting and maybe being more versatile than he would normally be if he had all of his, you know, 4 years worth of recruits in his arsenal?
Yeah, I do, because I think he has to be right now, Larry. I think he, and that, and you saw it against Northwestern State, a little bit more gun than he probably wanted to go, probably a few more zone reads than he wanted to have, probably went tempo in the red zone a few more times than he would have liked to, just because I think he knows, okay, this is what he's comfortable with. This is what we know he can handle. We know this is not going to rattle him. If this can give us a little bit of an advantage or just make somebody else prepare for it, then let's go out and do it a few times. Now, they're not going to make a living on that like the last staff did, but it gives them the opportunity to at least have it, and then it gives them the opportunity to force other people to prepare for it. So I think you'll see a little bit of it. I think having Daryl Dickey on staff also helps, because he's done it all. I mean, he's been pro style. He's been spread. He's been run and shoot. He's been fun and gun. I mean, he's done everything. So he can sort of help with some of those concepts as well, spreading teams out. Because that, I mean, if it's me, I'm getting the quarterback on the edge, and I'm taking everything quick hitter that you've given me, whether it's back out of the backfield, whether it's uncovered receivers, and I'll make that defense run. Sideline to sideline to sideline to sideline to sideline, and then I'll try to hit them over the middle a little bit later, and maybe try to peel off some runs a little bit later. And you still might not be able to, but I think that sort of has to be part of your game plan early in the season. And let's be honest, guys aren't in game shape yet. I mean, we think they are. Trust me, nobody's in game shape week one. You're just not. It's like Clowney a couple of years ago when people are getting on to him, like, we all were back. We're all sucking wind week one. Because you can go scrimmage and you can go run, you know, hundreds, and you can go run gassers, and you can have hard practices. The intensity will never be matched of what game one, two, and three is going to be. And it's hotter than it's going to be later in the year. So it takes time to get in football shape. And these guys don't practice enough in the off season. They don't go pads enough to really get their bodies acclimated to it. So that to me is one of the few chances that A&M might have of keeping this game close.
You ever seen a defensive line like this one that Clemson has?
Well, I played against Georgia with Richard Seymour and Marcus Stroud and Kendrell Bell and Charles Grant, so that one was pretty good. I mean, based on what those guys did, I know that was I think three first rounders. I think Grant went in the first round the next year, and then Seymour and Stroud, I know, were both first rounders. So they weren't a lot of fun to deal with. You know, I played against Florida defensive line with Gerard Warren and Alex Brown. That one was pretty good. But I think what separates this group is the amount of football that they've played. Like, all of these guys have pretty much been the guy at their position since they pretty much stepped on campus. And, you know, you got other D-lines where guys have been good for a year or two, but then most of those guys usually leave, so they're not all together. So not only do you have a lot of guys that have played a lot of football, you got a lot of guys that have played a lot of football at the same time. And that's difficult because they know how to run a twist. They know how to run a game. They know how to make up for a mistake. They know what other guys are going to do as far as pass rush lanes. I mean, that wherewithal is really valuable. And I can just imagine the kind of communication that they have up front, because they've all seen everything. I mean, what blocking scheme or alignment or personnel grouping has that Clemson defensive line not seen? Like, I would assume those guys are probably calling most of the plays. Like, they're running that defense. They can have an inside linebacker that's making calls and, you know, identifying strengths and whatever, but those dudes run that defense just because they've seen so much of it. And that's so valuable to have guys on the field that nothing can get past them because they've already seen it.
Well, Cole, you've been very generous with your time. I've enjoyed coming on your show periodically, and on behalf of my listeners to the Clemson Dubcast, really, really appreciate it.
Hey, anytime. You know, special place in my heart for Clemson. Marianne Grant, Hall of Famer as a basketball player there. So I've had many trips to Clemson. I went to Clemson Carolina games growing up. Both my parents are Gamecock graduates. So that rivalry, it's funny, that rivalry meant more to me growing up than the Iron Bowl did for the first probably 17, 16 years of my life. So it's I enjoy being around it. I enjoy keeping up with it, and I appreciate you having me on.
I can't let you off the hook after you give us that nugget. I had no idea. What games did you go to? What era was this?
Well, I mean, I was asleep in the stands for a bunch of them. You know, I used to go just to watch the Clemson Tiger and Cocky get in fights. My grandparents would drag me to those games. And, you know, my family grew up in Columbia. When I was growing up, my entire family lived in Columbia, aunts, uncles, grandparents. And My mom and dad went to South Carolina. My dad's brother went to South Carolina. My mom's brother and sister and all their kids went to South Carolina. My aunt was kind of a little wolf that went off to Clemson. And, you know, she was pretty incredible. Alternate for the 88 Olympic team. I think she's 2-time All-American. She was a pretty awesome basketball player for Clemson and has beaten me a horse every time we've played in my entire life. But she was the cool part is she went in the Hall of Fame the same night as the Fridge. So that was pretty cool being there for that. But I went to a bunch of Carolina Clemson games growing up. I'll never forget one we went to, and I think she had just graduated, and it was like William Perry's last year or something. They had, you remember those old posters of athletes that they would have, and they'd have like the measuring stick next to them, like tall they were? They had like that tall life-size poster of the Fridge, and she had it on her friend's RV. We were tailgating, not just a little kid. And she like went around the corner to see somebody, and my uncle takes this like giant South Carolina logo sticker and puts it on his mouth up with the giant poster. And like those two just, I mean, they had it out for probably an hour after she came back and saw it. He thought it was the funniest thing ever. She was furious. But yeah, I know that rivalry very well. I grew up with it. So
that must have been 1984 in Death Valley if that was the Fridge's last game.
It was. I know it was in Clemson. So yeah. And I was asleep in the stands. So I don't remember too much of the actual game. But yeah, it was fun growing up with it.
That is fantastic. Thanks again, Cole. Really appreciate it.
Anytime. Look forward to catching up soon.
All right. That was really cool. Enjoyed that. Did not expect the, or did not know of, the Clemson-South Carolina angle with him having spent a lot of time growing up in the Palmetto State. Thanks to everybody for listening. Really appreciate it. Thanks to our title sponsor, Parham Smith and Archenhold Law Firm in Greenville. Thank you to the Abernathy in Clemson, Tandem Payment in Greenville. Thanks to the City Champs for providing some killer bumper music. And again, thank you to you all for downloading the podcast and listening to it. Should be a fun weekend. Y'all have fun and be safe out there. Cheers.